The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Craig H. D. Armon presiding.
Morning, counsel. Our next case is 4-22-0859, Caitlin S. versus Corbin B. Could counsel for the appellant please state your name for the record?
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Leslie Wood for Corbin B., the appellant.
Thank you. And counsel for the appellee, could you please state your name for the record?
Yes, Sean Reese.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Wood, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to the panel. My name is Leslie Wood, and I am here today representing the appellant Corbin Burford, who is the father of the minor child at issue, who I will refer to as R.S. She's 10 years old. The appeal is brought pursuant to Illinois Supreme Court Rule 303 from a final judgment in Macoupin County Circuit Court rendered August 16, 2022. On behalf of the appellant Corbin B., I intend to present you with three reasons to reverse and remand this cause back to the trial court level. I'm also presenting you with a question of law and also a question of fact on behalf of the appellant. First, it is our contention, and excuse me, I'm losing my voice, so I apologize. It is our contention that the trial court did not have proper subject matter jurisdiction to enter an order modifying the allocation of parental decision-making and thereby stripping Corbin B. of his equal decision-making responsibilities that had been ordered previously in the trial court. The trial court granted relief not requested by either party in their pleadings that were before the court at the time of trial. Second, it is our position that the trial court's decision to deny equal parenting time and to remove equal decision-making was against the manifest weight of the evidence presented at trial, was contrary to the multiple recommendations of the guardian ad litem, Ian Murphy, and against the best interest of the minor child, R.S. The decision rewarded the child's mother, Caitlin S., for her demonstrated unwillingness to co-parent with the father, Corbin B. Third, the ruling to modify the right of first refusal from 2 hours to a 10-hour time window was against the manifest weight of the evidence presented, against the GAL recommendation, which was to remove the right of first refusal entirely, and that the 10-hour right of first refusal acts as an unreasonable restriction of Corbin B.'s parenting time because he works a 12-hour shift as a police officer and a member of the National Guard, whereas the mother, Caitlin S., works 8-hour shifts in healthcare. I would like to point out to this court that I was not the trial attorney for Corbin B. in this matter, and to let the court know that I have not been able to speak to the trial attorney or review the client file. My record of my review of the record and transcript show that there were only 3 witnesses at trial whose testimony was helpful or meaningful to the court, that being Corbin B., Caitlin S., and the GAL, Ian Murphy.
Good morning, counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
May I interrupt you? I wanted to get through your introductory remarks. To your first point with regard to subject matter jurisdiction, you rely in your brief on 3 cases, Ayala, Fox, and Otwell. But in each of those cases, the trial court sua sponte addressed an issue without prior notice to the parties. Here, we have a different situation. The parties did both request rulings regarding decision-making responsibilities, certainly in their closing arguments. So the trial court did not address that issue without notice or sua sponte. I mean, it's clear that the common law record has the written closing arguments at 302 to 304 and 317 to 322. And certainly within those arguments, there is argument with regard to decision-making responsibilities. So I'm not sure how these cases support your point of no jurisdiction here.
Your Honor, if I could address that, a review of the transcript will show on transcript page 5 and 6, the court asked the parties, are we here to I'm paraphrasing and I apologize. Are we here to modify the parenting plan? And the party said yes. There was no specific question about what part of the parenting plan the parties were there to modify. The court did not parse out whether or not they were there to modify decision-making or parenting time. And if you review the pleadings that both parties filed prior to it, you actually have to go all the way back to mother's initial pleading that she filed 9/6/2019, which is referred to in the appendix at A16. And you will find that her pro se motion at that time basically stated the only reason for a significant change in circumstances was that the father didn't give adequate notice of his permanent change of residence.
We know, counsel, that parenting plan that was being reviewed did have material or with regard to decision-making responsibility, correct?
The parenting plan that was, all parenting plans include both. I'm not sure if I understood right. Your question, Judge.
Well, it was in there. And so are you saying that the closing arguments that were presented to the court shouldn't have had that material regarding decision-making responsibilities and what the parties wanted respectively with regard, with respect to that?
To Your Honor, my client never changed his position. He had equal parenting and he argued for equal parenting, decision-making, and he argued for equal decision-making. There was no notice prior to trial that decision-making was going to be modified. In fact, if you look, the last GAL report was only 9 days before trial. There were no pleadings. And in Ayala and Fox and Otwell and all of the progeny from those cases indicate that the pleadings must conform to the proofs and vice versa. In this instance, if you review the pleadings, us being a notice pleading state, there's nothing in any of the pleadings from either party that talks about that. Yes, so I do admit,
So they had no notice?
I do not believe that my client, no, the answer is
there
no.
There was testimony regarding decision-making responsibility at the July 27th hearing, was there not?
There was testimony regarding the inability of the parents to communicate, and I would submit to the court that the inability of the parents to communicate was being presented as evidence that equal parenting time was not going to be tenable, 50-50 parenting time, which was Caitlin S.'s argument, that 50-50 parenting time was not in the best interest of the child. Dad was simply testifying at trial about communications between the parties to demonstrate to the court that he was not being taken into consideration and the times that the mom was taking the child to the doctor, this or that. And he was showing the court that the decisions that were being made unilaterally by mom were not in the child's best interest. But I don't think that that was being presented in his attempt to modify the equal parenting time that existed. It was testimony given by both parties about their inability to communicate, which was consistent with an argument that Caitlin S. was making for not having 50-50. But at no time was my client on notice that his equal parenting time was at risk at the time that he went to trial. Caitlin didn't ask for the equal parenting to be removed, and the GAL didn't recommend that the equal parenting be removed. And certainly Corbin V did not ask for the equal parenting time to be removed.
Counsel, am I mistaken? I thought he asked to vacate the parenting agreement.
No, he did not, Your Honor. Caitlin S. asked to vacate the March 4th parenting agreement. The timeline of this case, Judge, and I'm not trying to argue with you, the timeline of this case is basically there was an initial GAL that made a report back in 2019, November 7th of 2019. GAL Kevin Polo makes a recommendation for shared decision making and gave specific parenting time to Corbin B. March 4th of 2020, without a hearing, the Macoupin County Court enters an order taking up Kevin Polo's recommendation as its order. Then on March 31st of 2020, mother Caitlin S. files a motion to reconsider or vacate the March 4th, 2020
order. I don't mean to interrupt you, but here's the reason I asked. And I agree. I think, well, obviously, you know the record better. And I think she was the one who wanted to vacate it. But why I ask is because when the hearing begins, the trial court points out that it seems kind of confusing because there's been a lot of activity, it says, and we don't know for sure what exactly is going on here. I just want to make sure that we get clarified before we hear testimony. And then there's the representation by Mr. Reese that they wanted to vacate the parenting agreement earlier, but then the testimony begins with your client. And it looks like from that point on, both parties start addressing the parenting agreement. So I'm trying to figure out how, if you're saying nobody seemed to know this was going to happen, how is it then that they were all prepared to testify about
it? I mean, I can tell you, Judge, that I interpreted the testimony that happened throughout the transcript as being evidence of cooperation and communication that would be consistent with arguments regarding parenting time. I do understand what you're saying, which is that you're saying that they're talking about their inability to cooperate. But that was basically testimony that's consistent with both parenting time and decision-making. But in this instance, because there are no pleadings on file prior to trial regarding a change of parental decision-making, that the testimony should be looked at in light of changing parenting time and not equal decision-making or not decision-making. If so the proofs at trial are not consistent with the pleadings, then the proofs at trial have to be consistent with the pleadings. That's what Ayala and Fox and Otwell are about, and go all the way back to the case I cited from 1931. Your proofs have to comport with your pleadings. And in this case, if you review the pleadings, Your Honor, there are no pleadings that mention terminating equal parental decision-making. And in fact, there's no pleadings on file that ask for that.
So after the order was entered, was there a motion then filed?
So the convoluted, unfortunate events that happened were that on August 16th, it's not convoluted, I apologize. On August 16th of 2022, the order was entered. The attorney for Corbin B. at that time did not file a post-trial motion until the date passed. And then when the date passed, I filed two things on behalf of my client, this appeal and also a motion to reconsider. The trial court has entered an order stating that because this case is on appeal, the court did not rule on the motion to reconsider. Was that the question, Your Honor?
Well, I guess that raises more questions, but I'll let them go.
Okay. If there are questions I can answer, I'd be happy to. But Judge, I apologize. I can't give you insight into what happened with the trial attorney because she is not communicating with me. So therefore I can't answer questions if you have any about what happened at trial or post-trial.
Okay, I can't resist.
I would love to speculate, but I don't think that's my place, Judge.
Since you filed both motions.
Yes.
Once the court indicated it wasn't going to address the one, why didn't you just wait to pursue your appeal and ask the trial court to enter a ruling to clarify its decision or to reconsider, so you'd have a trial record on that exact issue?
If you look, Judge, I did file, Mr. Reese and I filed a joint motion asking for the appeal to be stayed so that we could go forward with the motion to reconsider in trial court, and this court denied that motion. If there's another remedy that I did not seek, I can only apologize. That was the remedy that Mr. Reese and I sought so that we could try and resolve the issue with Judge Deal in Macoupin County. But when the appeal was not stayed, the trial court refused to go forward.
Once you filed the notice, you've taken jurisdiction away from the trial court. So
right.
What would have been the prejudice to simply dismissing the appeal and proceeding with the motion?
Well, I consulted with my client, Judge, and this was the route that my client chose to take.
Yeah, but see, you're the lawyer. You're the one that's got the law degree.
Understand. Yes, Your Honor, that's correct, but I believe that at the time the appeal was ripe and I was uncomfortable with the idea of dismissing the appeal because of the timeline with Rule 311. I counseled my client that it was best to go forward on this in this appeal.
Okay, I apologize for taking up your time. Please go ahead.
No, you're fine, Judge. I mean, I'm open to criticism, but ultimately I think it's my client's right to go forward with the appeal, and you can second guess that right, but here we are. So I guess I would ask the court to consider. I'm not sure what the trial court could have cleared up. Certainly, it was very clear that the judge had what I guess I would say the trial court had seen these folks throughout the child's life, and the parties have returned to the trial court throughout the child's life. The 2019 motion to vacate was not ruled on until 2022 ultimately, and that was in concert with my client's petition to modify parenting time. The reason for that was that my client had moved within 1 mile of Caitlin S. and the child, and with that small amount of travel time, he had asked the court to grant him equal parenting time. The child goes to the same school as the stepchildren, the half siblings now that live in Corbin B's house. He is a police officer and he works every other weekend. And that is one of the concerns that my client has, and that I would ask this court to consider, is the 10-hour, I'm kind of skipping around a little bit here, but the 10-hour right of first refusal. The original
That 10-hour on that point, counsel, that the trial court was looking or meant to, by that 10-hour right of first refusal, prioritize RS's spending time with her mother rather than her stepmother when Corbin had to work during his scheduled parenting time. Isn't that correct? And
yes.
Okay. And in light of the concerns that the GAL raised in at least one report, if not more, about RS feeling bullied by her stepsister and wanting to be with her stepmother only when both parents were working, why was this right of first refusal against the manifest weight of the evidence?
Because, Your Honor, it only works against one parent. It doesn't work against the other. And so it's basically punishing dad, but not, there's no recourse for dad is when mom's working. Mom uses her family to watch the child when she's working, and the reciprocal arrangement does not work. So it's a one-sided right of first refusal.
Well, if we look at this right of first refusal and how it was used, isn't this actually punishing the child? Having the child get up early in the morning. Now I know this relates to Caitlin, but go home at 4:30 in the morning, isn't that how this operated between these two parents? And wasn't this indicative of their behavior during the course of this litigation?
Your Honor, I find the case, it's a Rule 23, and I did cite it in my brief, and I do understand the limitations of Rule 23. But there's a phrase used in Ray MM that sort of resonates with me called time trumping. The GAL in that case calls it time trumping. And I think that the right of first refusal is problematic when it's weaponized by the parents and used to time trump, which is what's happening in this case. And it may have happened throughout the case, which is why one could anticipate that the GAL, by his last final report 9 days before trial, recommended to get rid of the right of first refusal altogether, because both of these parties weaponize it. And again, I'm in love with the phrase time trumping, and I think it applies in this case. And I do think that these parties use it against each other, regardless of whether they're spending equal time or not.
Against each other to the detriment of the child.
Anything that's weaponized against each other is obviously going to negatively affect the best interests of the child.
Right. So isn't that the reason, or could that not be the reason, that the trial court did what it did with regard to granting the 10-hour right of first refusal, knowing the facts regarding the situation at Corbin's home with his wife and children, and certainly knowing what was going on with regard to the relationship of RS with her mother?
I would point out to Your Honor that in the transcript, when Caitlin S. is testifying, she's asked, why she proposed the 10 hour. And she specifically says in her testimony that she does it to limit Corbin's time with the child. Under those circumstances, I think that the court should and recognize that this is an attempt by the mother specifically to limit father's time. There's nothing in it about the best interest of the child. She doesn't argue that she's doing it to protect her child. She's saying it's to limit the time with the child. Under those circumstances, I don't think that the court can reasonably continue to keep a 10-hour right of first refusal when the court knows that it's only being used against one person. And in fact, when dad is off during the week, especially in the summer, he does not have the same ability because to have the child in his care because mom works 8 hours and the right of first refusal doesn't kick in. So he will not get the child during his time when he's off work and he's at home. He will not get the child because it's a 10-hour right of first refusal and mom never kicks in. There is, and thank you, under those two, sorry.
Ms. Wood, your time is up. You will be given an opportunity on rebuttal. Mr. Reese.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're on mute, Mr. Reese.
Thank you, Justices. May it please the court and counsel. It is the appellee's position that the trial court made a proper ruling on the allocation of parental responsibilities, including decision-making responsibility and parenting time. The court had subject matter jurisdiction over this matter because there was no question by the parties that it was in dispute. And additionally, the court's ruling on the evidence presented on allocation of decision-making and parenting time was not against the manifest weight of the evidence. Now, regarding decision-making responsibility on subject matter jurisdiction, central to the case cited by the appellant is a notice issue. There was proper notice on the issue of decision-making responsibility because the parties had discussed it prior to and at the trial, notifying the court that the parenting plan would be modified and that there was no, that the issue of changed circumstances wasn't an issue, that all parties agreed the parenting plan needed to be modified.
Did there have to be pleading, counsel, with regard to the decision-making responsibility? And we know there was no pleading, correct?
And reviewing the record, there was no pleading on the issue of significant decision-making only. However, there was discovery issued, which is on C-248 and C-250. And the certificate, those are only the certificates of service, but the certificates of service from both parties indicate that there were interrogatories on the allocation of parental responsibility and parenting time. And the appellant's discovery was interrogatories related to parental responsibility. The GAL investigated these issues provided for in the decision-making issues in his fourth supplemental report. The GAL would not have known to do that otherwise had there not been notice to all parties on decision-making. And there was quite a bit of testimony on questions about medical decision-making, health decision-making, education, and religion. There was a lot of testimony and cross-examination on both issues, specifically orthodontia and the trouble that Ms. Shoemake was having when trying to co-parent with father and getting nowhere on that issue. There was additional testimony on attending the appointments for these, on the medical appointments. There was cross-examination on why mother eventually stopped trying to communicate with father to coordinate appointment dates.
Didn't the evidence really indicate that she excluded him from this process of significant decision-making such a by not giving him notice of the medical appointments?
I disagree, Your Honor. She was giving him notice, and there was a portion of the transcript that talks about why she stopped giving him notice. And there was a text message exchange between the parties, and the father says something to the effect of, statements don't require a response. unless it's an emergency. You would get a response from me if this was an emergency. Otherwise, statements don't require a response. And in that text message, it was the mother trying to coordinate a date, I believe it was for orthodontia, with father so that he could attend the appointment.
Well, the fact of the matter is they weren't cooperating on anything, including haircuts. I mean, doesn't the GAL report include information that father wanted to, at his whim, give have her get her haircut from a different person at a different place, a different time? So how was it against the manifest weight of the evidence for the trial court to place a decision making with your client? Was it?
I'm sorry, I don't know they understood the question.
Okay. Given the fact that these parties couldn't cooperate on anything regarding decisions as, quote, insignificant, apparently, as haircuts and who and when and where those should take place, how was it against the manifest weight of the evidence for the trial court to have awarded the decision-making responsibility to your client? Was it against the manifest weight, or was this a decision that the trial court had sufficient evidence to make?
The trial court had sufficient evidence to make this ruling and provided express findings on the best interest factors related to that decision making. On these issues, I believe there were nine expressed factors that the court reviewed in its order before making the ultimate ruling that decision making should be only to mother. And one of those factors was the GAL's recommendation. But the court went beyond issues that the GAL identified in his report and expressly provided why the court declined to follow the GAL's recommendation.
You want to comment for a minute on the, before we run out of time, I know you still have some time, but the right of first refusal, and do you agree with opposing counsel that father was deprived of his parenting time based on the trial court awarding the 10-hour right of first refusal?
So I believe the court made a proper ruling on the right of first refusal, and that father was not deprived parenting time. This is time father would not have otherwise because father may be working or whatever the case may be. The appellant is trying to paint a picture that the right of first refusal only applies to the hours that parents work. There's numerous reasons a right of first refusal could be applied. It could be with health issues. It could be for a funeral, a wedding, having to go to a work conference. There's numerous ways it could kick in. If it was a 24-hour right of first refusal, father would be complaining that it only affects him because he's in the Illinois National Guard and would frequently or occasionally have to go attend those matters when mother is not.
Now, when your client exercised her right of first refusal, she insisted on pre-dawn transfers, at least over the weekend, isn't that correct? Rather than allowing RS to sleep in for a few hours when her stepmother was at home. So how does that, why doesn't this concern show that this 10-hour right of first refusal really was against the manifest weight of the evidence when it was clear that it was used this way?
I disagree that it was mother requiring the child to be brought over at 4:30 a.m. I believe the transcript also shows mother saying she had made those same suggestions, and it was father forcing those early exchanges. I believe both parties blamed the other throughout the trial on the right of first refusal. And then additionally, I think the main issue in it's identified in the case that the appellant has cited was when you have parents that have high conflicts like these two, the right of first refusal needs to have a larger amount of time. the right of first refusal previously was for 2 hours, requiring frequent uses of it, whereas this 10-hour right of first refusal would require less. The appellants also argued the JAL recommended no right of first refusal. On, I believe it was page 54, R154, when the JALs asked at the trial, what is your opinion on the right of first refusal? The JAL said, I'm wary of it and that it wasn't needed, especially because it's 50-50 parenting time. So his answer on right of first refusal was on the premise that the parties had 50-50 parenting time. There was no discussion on if it wasn't 50-50 parenting time, then what do you think? And then I believe it's also apparent from the record, the child wanted to be with mother or father if mother or father were available, not stepmother, which again goes back to why the court would submit a right of first refusal and keep it in place and increasing it to 10 hours versus the 2 hours to reduce the interactions between the parents and hopefully reduce the conflict.
Well, she certainly didn't want to be awakened at 4:30 in the morning.
No, absolutely not.
Certainly didn't want to be awakened at 4:30 in the morning to transfer from one parent's home to another.
Agreed. Have I answered your questions related to the right of first refusal, Your Honor?
I believe so. Thank you.
I believe the only other arguments on the subject matter jurisdiction was the testimony presented, the closing arguments presented, and the best interest analysis. Going on to whether or not it was the decision on decision-making was against the manifest weight of the evidence, we've somewhat discussed that here. The court makes express findings referring to the record on all relevant matters, 9 factors. The appellant is really only arguing that one of those factors was at issue, that being the JAL's recommendation, which the court also addresses why the court declined to follow that recommendation.
So the trial court, did the trial court ignore the GAL's recommendation? I mean, the GAL came down, with equal parenting time, and you referred to the other recommendation regarding right of first refusal. Wasn't the trial court obligated to give more weight to the GAL's recommendations?
There's no case law that I can find where the trial court had to give the JAL's recommendation more weight. The case law supports that a JAL's recommendation is simply that, a recommendation. Reasonable minds can differ. The JAL's report brings up issues of parental alienation, father and stepmother, on possible improper influence of the child on desiring equal parenting time. And the JAL chose not to weigh that heavily, whereas the court did weigh that heavily. The JAL didn't address in his report the threats by father to take full custody of the child's mother. The JAL also seemed to give the opinion that because of these parents' positions and their intelligence, that they should be able to communicate, but responsibly with one another related to the child. But the record reflects that's not the case, and there is no end in sight on that being resolved. When father's asked at trial, what's your solution on communication? He responded something to the effect of less communication. Mother, I believe, when asked the same question, she asked for communication. She saw it as very one-sided. She's texting him on numerous different issues, and she gets next to no response. Additionally, the JAL didn't address in his report the father's frequent changes in not only his residence and employment and his schedule. That wasn't evaluated by the JAL, whereas the court did evaluate that. The JAL's recommendation was partially based on the child's wishes, but the court noted that there really wasn't a basis for the child's wishes, meaning that child wanted equal time, but why? The child wasn't able to explain that. The child's maturity wasn't identified at trial. There was no evidence presented on the basis for her wishes or her maturity and express reasons for her wish. And the court could interpret the JL's report as being there was improper influence as one reason why the child told the JL that she wanted equal time. And then the court also placed very little weight on the child's wishes itself because of those shortcomings. Going back to the right of first refusal, the appellant argues the right of first refusal is a restriction. The court specifically denied to review any factor related to a restriction on parenting time because it was not proper. I see no case law cited to support the argument that placing a right of first refusal is an unreasonable restriction on a parent's time. The JL didn't give an opinion on the right of first refusal in a scenario where it wasn't a 50-50 allocation. And there's no reason that the appellants also argued that the court didn't provide an analysis for its right of first refusal. Again, the court provided express findings on all best interest factors related to parental responsibility. On the allocation of parenting time, it appears that the trial court made 12 express findings on the best interest factors, express findings on 12 of the factors. In reviewing arguments by the appellant, it seems that there's really only two arguments by the appellant that the court did not follow the child's wishes and the court did not follow the JL's recommendation. Again, the JL's recommendation is simply that. The court's not obligated to follow it. There would be no point to having a JL. There'd be no point to having a hearing if we just rubber stamped any recommendation a JL submitted. On the wishes of the child, and I've addressed this to some extent, the trial court identified improper influence of dad and stepmom. No maturity, no evidence on her maturity or expressed reasons for wanting equal time. And the court weighed this factor, but didn't put much weight on it, but did say it weighed slightly in favor of equal parenting time being allocated. And then we're back to, it would have been factor 17 in the court's order that the court recognized the JL's recommendation, but declined to follow it when reviewing the party's work schedules, the father having Illinois National Guard obligations, living situations, mother having a consistent work schedule, father moving three times since 2018 and testifying that he may move again, father's threats of taking full custody away from Caitlin, and father's refusal to communicate with mother on basic parenting time issues. In addition to that, father's parental interference that was identified in the JL report and through testimony. There's no suggestion here that the court's ruling, the evidence is sufficient to support the court's ruling in this matter. And there's no basis to overrule the trial court's ruling. It would appear that the appellant is trying to replace the JAL's recommendation for the courts, or in the alternative to have this court put its own judgment in place of the trial courts, which isn't the purpose of this appeal. The appellant has failed to overcome the standard of the ruling being against the manifest weight of the evidence, and the appeal should be denied. I really have nothing further to state unless there's any other questions.
I see none. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wood, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to address a couple of things that came up in Mr. Reese's argument. In fact, there was some testimony from the GAL at the end of trial on page 153 of the transcript. The court asks, or he has asked, what opinion do you have regarding a right of first refusal in this case? And he doesn't say none. He says very limited. So basically in his report, he says no right of first refusal because it's a 50-50 suggestion for parenting time. However, at trial, he's asked what his opinion is regarding a right of first refusal. He says very limited. And then he basically goes on to say why, but he was asked the question. He did give an answer and he wasn't impeached at trial. No one cross-examined him to find that there was any basis for throwing out his report or that he didn't do a sufficient report. In fact, he did a yeoman's job as a GAL, in my opinion, for what that's worth. He met with the child and spoke to her on the phone. He met with her at her mom's house, at her dad's house, in his own office. He met with her multiple times and has pointed out in my brief on behalf of the appellant, the GAL is the only and best person to evaluate the child's wishes because the court never met the child. The judge never met the child. She didn't testify. There was no in-camera of this child. The GAL is the only person who could evaluate her, and he evaluated her over and over again. And to now, discount—
Well, you were saying discount, but the trial court never disparaged the work that the GAL did.
Correct.
He just decided differently, or the case came out differently. His decision was different with regard to the matters we've been talking about today than the GAL's recommendations, but there was no disparagement of the work that the GAL did.
That's correct, Your Honor. If you look at Petritus, and I apologize, I'm next to the fire station if you hear a siren. If you read some of the cases wherein the court, Petritus and other cases, there was some effort to impeach the GAL. And in this case, there was no impeachment of the GAL at all. He gave his testimony, nobody impeached him. And then the court obviously has the wherewithal and the authority to rule against the GAL. But in this instance, with all of the work that the GAL did, really the illumination of what happened in this case came through the GAL. And to rule completely against what the GAL recommended in this case is against the manifest weight of the evidence in light of some of the other testimony that was given, in that Caitlin S. refused to also communicate with Corbin B. And she should not reap the benefit of having sole decision-making and primary parenting time and what she has, when she also, and the testimony shows, she also refused to communicate and work with Corbin B. This was
right,
not a
so
one-sided.
Maybe what the trial court was looking at and certainly had to look at was the best interests of the child.
Of course.
Not having one parent benefit and the other one benefit, but have the child benefit from the decision that is made. So that's the job of the trial court, to actually look at all the evidence, including the GAL report, and come up with that type of decision, which is what the trial court did here.
Right, Your Honor, and I agree with you, except for back in 2019, the court did the complete opposite thing by also trying to reduce the conflict between the parties, and it seems to be going from one extreme to the other in this instance, and it still isn't reducing the conflict, and the child is basically being torn apart by it, and I think we can all agree about that, but by awarding mother everything does not stop the trauma that goes on with this child, in the respect that she her relationship with her father is impaired, and that cannot possibly be in the best interest of a minor child. I would ask the court to reverse and remand to also on the issues of parenting time and the right of first refusal, and to void the order regarding parental decision-making and find that the trial court did not have subject matter jurisdiction to enter that order. And I thank the panel for your time and attention to this case.
All right, thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement. The court stands in recess.